Mostly, this afternoon's talk is about, it's like the beginning of a talk on the seven factors of enlightenment. I hope I can get to the first two. So the seven factors are mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, calm, concentration, and equanimity. And the three that happen after mindfulness, the investigation, energy, and rapture are all the energizing factors. And the calm, concentration, and equanimity are considered the tranquilizing factors. And mindfulness is considered to be like the weft of a weaving. Wait a minute, no, the warp. Mindfulness is like the warp of a weaving. It's necessary for all the other factors to come into balance and to develop. So I'll be spending probably a lot of time on mindfulness. All right, this talk and some on investigation. A few months ago, I was driving and had the radio on. It's not often I get that experience. And there was a program on that the interviewer was interviewing a man who had been the principal of a high school near Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm not sure exactly when this was, 20 years ago or 18 years ago, but sometime he had been a principal of the school for a long time, and he had retired, and he had been asked to develop a high school where people who were in the kind of normal category or gifted or really mentally handicapped or physically handicapped or learning disabled. I don't know the modern politically correct word for that, but there's probably a word for that now that's different than I was trained. But just like the whole range of physical and emotional, mental intelligence, he was asked to create a high school that integrated everyone. And in that time period, it was considered crazy, you know, not possible, and that it would really drag down the more intelligent, you know, in a more, the more kind of, again, from the normal range and above. It was always considered that this wouldn't be good for those students. And I find it even hard to talk about this because it so touched me when I listened to him. It just makes me cry what he discovered. Like, he discovered that by holding everyone accountable for their best, that everyone did better. And he found that the students that were in that more normal range to more gifted range were actually the most, they did the best because they could see that their friends and students in the classrooms were having to work so hard at things that were somewhat more easier for them. And it was like it just cut through their arrogance. It just cut through their sense of like taking for granted what they had and not working up to their potential. But really it was like everyone in the community affected each other, and it was all based on doing your best and being held accountable for doing your best. And it was an extraordinary school. And I guess I just feel like we always... sometimes on a retreat, not that we're in that extreme a category, but we can tend to forget that what our best is unique. But it is something that we need to hold ourselves to, hold ourselves accountable to. And I think where we get in trouble is where we will want or get attached to the results of the effort. We want to control our practice. We want to control what's happening through the result of the effort, not with just that pure exploration, pure investigation. And this is very paradoxical. It's very hard to do, to hold ourselves accountable to our best in each other, and then really just have that sense of like trusting that whatever we're working with in our practice is what we're working with, and not to worry about what's happening for other people. In a very different way, but it's similar. Over some years, I had a student come to retreat that it was very challenging for him to come to a, you know, do day after day after day of retreat. And he would shake, really, his body would just shake and shake during the sittings and over years. And I would notice that he would have a thermos that he carried around with him. And after a few years, when he came in for an interview, I could smell that it was coffee. And he was drinking coffee all day, all night. And, you know, it was making him shake. And it was just, you notice these things as a teacher. But I noticed it was just so challenging for him. And no one would sit near him. Ever. There'd be like this big wide space because he shook, right? And then one retreat, this woman came to this retreat and she came in for an interview, and I said to her, "Wow, you are the first person I've seen who's been willing to sit next to this person." And I was like, I was so happy that you did that and so grateful. And I said, How come you did that? Why did you do that? She didn't know that no one would sit next to him for years. And she said, "Oh, I just felt like I saw him sitting there shaking, and I thought, you know, if he can do this, I can do this." Nothing about her being, right, bothered or like, you know, just not at all getting that sense of being bothered. So much the sense of like, wow, very similar, right? If he can do this, I can do this. Inspiration. And I got to tell you, they helped, it's like no words ever spoken, and they helped each other in the practice just by sitting next to each other, like a lot. I could see it. You know, so we have to remember that, you know, we slog along. You know, one of my favorite ever quotations is from a book by Kathleen Norris. And she had moved to North Dakota from Hawaii, Honolulu, to help care for her grandmother when her grandmother was dying. And she started to get to know these Benedictine monks that lived nearby. There was a monastery nearby. And after some years, her grandmother died. She inherited the house. She moved there. And she started getting to know the place more, the monastery. So she decided to write a book about her experience getting to know these monks. And she interviewed them, and she saved this interview with the oldest monk there. He was 92. He'd been there since he was very young. She asked him, "What is your biggest obstacle to God?" And he didn't think twice. Like, it was one of those things that didn't go through the thought process. He just said, "Oh, the other monks." You know, and it's just, that's how it is. And yet, here we are. I mean, it's like, and yet we might say for all of us, you know, if we could just go off and not have to be bothered with each other and just do it ourselves, it's actually not possible. And it's really all the stuff we go through with each other, you know, that really is what makes it possible to see our stuff again and again. You know, and I wasn't planning to talk about this, but it's like, this is reminding me of earlier this year, there was this wild feral cat that came by my place, and she was so skinny and starving. And I knew that I travel a lot, and I went out there and I told her, look, you know, I am not a good person for you to get involved with, but I'm like willing to give you some milk, but please don't, you know, I'm going to be gone for long periods, and who knows what she got out of that. But so I started feeding her milk every day. And it was like, I knew that I didn't want to get to like whole food, right, to cat, you know, cat food bought, because I didn't want her to get too dependent on me. And then after a little bit, I had been away for a long time. I came back. She was still alive, but very skinny, starving. Started giving her more milk. And then she started going through a half gallon a day. And I'm like, oh, something's not right. This is a lot of milk. Really, I'd pour it in. She'd lick it all up, you know, like a little teeny tongue. Would just lick it all up and another thing of milk, another thing of milk. And I'm like, something's wrong. And then I started looking at her closer, and I'm like, oh, she's pregnant, right? So here, you know, there's this care and connection, but I didn't sign up for that, right? I didn't, in my mind, I hadn't signed up for that. And it's a very long story, but it turns out not only was she pregnant at that point, but she had already had kittens, and she was hiding them from me. So she already had kittens, and I had to go away. And you know, when you care about something, it gets complex. Yeah, it doesn't stay simple. But we want to control. So it turns out that when I got back the next time, there were four cats there, four, from one little moment, right, of putting a little milk in a jar, you know, in a thing. There were four. And I, you know, looked up in the internet, and because I decided, well, they better be fixed, right? If they don't get fixed, we're going to have 24 cats soon. And this is a big problem in Hawaii. There are huge, huge feral cat colonies, huge. Like, and really, it's the only answer is for different people to take on fixing them. And anyway, got them fixed, trapped them, you know, the whole business, dewormed, shots. And then they, you know, you start to get to know them, but they will never let you touch them. But there was an article I read on the internet that said, managing your feral cat colony. Managing your feral cat colony. And I'm like, no, it's not a colony. I'm not managing a cat colony. This is a family. And I started projecting all this stuff. Like, it was amazing. I wasn't even doing this with other human beings. There were four cats, and I knew she only had two kittens because I had to arrange, like, people to come feed these beings when I was away. It's like I had a whole schedule. You know, it was very complicated. So when I got back, I heard, you have two kittens, but there were four cats. And then there was one big one, and I thought, finally I figured out, well, clearly this is the father. And some days in a feral cat colony, sometimes they disappear, sometimes they're back. And every day I would have a new projection. Oh, because I read a lot about, like, sometimes the father kills the kittens, right? So one time the kittens didn't come, and I'm like, the father killed the kittens. You know, another day it's like the mother disappeared. And, you know, the kittens wouldn't let the mother have food. And it was amazing, all the stuff I would do just every day. And then I reread Managing Your Cat Colony, and it said that you would go through all this emotional stuff, you know? And we do that with each other constantly. You know? I mean, I love retreats this way because, you know, I just love looking at people's sandals and shoes or like how they walk. Or you can just make the most amazing stories about people. And, you know, the kind of old way of talking about this in the Vipassana world would be that we can get attracted to somebody. And on a retreat, we can, like, you know, marry them, divorce them, you know, have kids, the whole thing, like, and we don't even know them. Or you can really not like somebody. You know, we call it the VVV and the VR, the Vipassana romance, the Vipassana vendetta, but it's just somebody, you've never talked to them, you don't know them, but it's just something is different. Instead of attraction, it's repulsion. And then there are the people you don't even notice. It's just, and it has nothing to do with them. Nothing. The best projection I had on the cat colony was, I thought it was, I finally decided that it was a happy family and that there was a father and a mother and two kittens, and that they were this happy family and the little kitties loved the father and that the father cared about the cats and had this whole thing. And then when I had them go get fixed, it turned out they were all female. It was like, you know, just total fantasy, you know? It was so shocking. All female? What? Where did she come from? How did she get pregnant? So, in regard to pleasant, unpleasant, aversion, attachment, it's like we get caught up in the object of the wanting. We think the object of the wanting is outside of us rather than pulling back the projection and knowing that the pleasant feeling is mental and it's happening inside us. And we get caught up in the object of the aversion or the object of the fear rather than pulling back the projection and seeing that we're getting fooled again. We get fooled over and over again. We think things are happening outside of us, when actually, even if you look at seeing, it's happening at the eye door, not out at the flower or at the star. The starlight is touching the eye right here. And the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling is actually happening in the mind door here. So when we talk about the suffering that ends suffering, and this is really important, this isn't a path of like just more and more suffering. It's meant to be a path where you're willing to investigate, to really check out, well, the nuts and bolts of suffering. Like, why is it that we aren't okay? And not just like an individual, I'm not okay. It's just, it's a universal, whether you're a gecko or a dog or a cat or a human or a deva or a god or goddess, that there is something going on here that really requires not going through the thought process, but really the wise investigation of just checking out again and again. When we feel off, when we feel like we're not quite right, when we're suffering, check it out. And it really usually gets distilled down to getting caught in some kind of control that we can't control. So, of course, mindfulness is the way that really empowers us to show up and have a presence with our experience where liberation is possible, rather than being oppressed by aversion or oppressed by attachment. We learn to investigate it and see that we don't have to be oppressed by those reactions to what's happening, the change of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So I'd like to describe like breaking down mindfulness into some aspects, but it's not meant to be a checklist. And it's not meant to be something that you go, oh, recognition, okay, I got that one down, and then acceptance, okay, I got that one down, interest, okay, I got that one down, non-identification. It's not like you go through a checklist as much as you start to see that when mindfulness feels very complete, that usually the awareness will include these aspects. And these aspects are also, it's not something you can command, but it's really like, again, you kind of start to explore what the opposites feel like. So, for example, recognition is the ability to really merely know your hearing, or merely know your tasting when you're eating, or, you know, merely, but merely, I mean that very carefully. It's that ability to know that you're walking when you're walking, or sad when you're sad, or, you know, anything that's happening. It's that recognition is coming out of the stupor. It's coming out of being asleep at the wheel. You know, it's coming out of being lost in thinking. And so we see that the opposite of recognition is distraction or being lost. And it's very important when we start describing these aspects of mindfulness that we start to realize that we're not trying to demonize the opposites or say they're bad and wrong. It's much more that you start learning that distraction isn't mindfulness. Do you see the difference? And that's so important, because we can start judging our practice or blaming ourselves or hating our practice, when really, any time you can bring your attention, you can recollect it. That's one of the definitions of sati, is recollecting. You're pulling your attention back from distraction. Kinesthetically, we might all have a different feeling or how that feels. For me, it'll feel like this. It's like Srinivasagadatta Maharaj said, it's affectionate awareness that brings reality into focus. So you're bringing reality into focus with affectionate awareness. So recognition has that, all these aspects, like I've learned, you know, as I've developed this, I've actually started to see that the recognition part will have and they're a lot all ours. You know, they have an aspect of the attention relaxing. And, you know, it's like that's usually the first part of remembering to be here. Something relaxes, you start remembering to be here, and then you recollect the attention, and then hopefully one receives something. One receives a vibration or the texture of physical sensations, or you receive sounds, or you receive thoughts as they are, as just thoughts. There's a quality of spaciousness. And yes, we are receiving non-conceptually. So like when I say we're aware that the thought is just a thought, so that you're aware that thinking is happening, you're aware that hearing is happening, you're not caught up in what's causing the sound. Yeah. So that's one aspect of mindfulness. We taught our first teenage retreat on the Big Island of Hawaii this year, and there was one 13-year-old that was sent by his grandmother to make sure that his older sister, who was sent by her grandmother, same grandmother, that she wouldn't run away. And I thought that's a terrible motivation, right? You know, he didn't even want to be there, but he was sent there to like make sure his sister didn't run away. I felt so much for him, you know, and he was just so restless. He had so much restlessness, and it hadn't rained for months and months, and it just decided to rain a lot, and we were in tents. And one morning I was walking toward the big tent we sit under for the instruction sitting, and I saw that his tent had been completely rained out, like, and his stuff, all his clothes were wet, and he was just like trying to just cope with like not having slept much and this wet tent. And I went up to him, and usually at a teenage retreat you really have to go around and try to collect people and make them come to the sittings, and this retreat it never happened. I mean, all of these teenagers just came. It was really easy and amazing. And he wasn't coming. So I went over there and I said, "What's up?" And he's like, it didn't need explanation. I just said, "What's up?" And he said, you know, not much. And then he said, "I'm a little bit frustrated, but I'm trying to be mindful of it." And he said, "Yes, I'm coming to the sitting." It was so great. "I'm a little bit frustrated, but I'm trying to be mindful of it." "I'm trying to be mindful of it." We do that a lot, yeah? But he had the recognition, and he was struggling with the acceptance. Pretty amazing. First retreat, didn't want to be there. "A little bit frustrated, but I'm going to be okay," you know? So acceptance and resistance. And, you know, in this talk, I'm really emphasizing also the opposite. The opposite, resistance, if you look at how much you're really present, then you know that resistance is happening a lot. And rather than feeling like resistance is not okay, bad, something you have to really push through, it's much more a sense of learning how to be mindful of it. You learn how to be mindful of being distracted, and when you come back from being distracted, like with recognition, you go, "Oh, okay," and you just do your best to be present. With resistance, it's like you just like with sleepiness or boredom or the breath, you note resistance, and then you just make space. You see if you can be interested in it, feel the physical sensations, or move away from it. Go to the anchor. But it's really like a 2-year-old mind or a 3-year-old mind. Resistance is like, "No, no, 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 this, I don't want this to be happening. I don't want to be here." You know, it's just like, "I was born like that." Somehow I really got the karma of that one. So it's like I always just say to myself, of course, resistance. It's okay. It's that unconditional acceptance, okay? Acceptance isn't condoning. And this is where we can get really confused in practice. And with the last factor of enlightenment, equanimity, it's the same thing. Mindfulness isn't about being passive or about being dissociated or about naivete or indifferent or not taking action. We get confused. Acceptance doesn't mean condoning. In this deeper mindfulness way, it means that we accept what's happening as a fact. It's a fact. Sleepiness is happening. And we can just, you know, do what we do around it, but low energy happens. Or restlessness. It's like when my sister died 10 years ago, I had never had much restlessness in practice. I had some, but not tons of it. And she died, and I had about a year of, like, serious restlessness. And it was, I mean, I have to say, it was really interesting. Like, I could hardly sit. And I'd never had to deal with it. And I'd practiced for many years. And I'd seen other people deal with it. But, you know, I'd go sit down to sit, and I'm like, better do some walking meditation. You know, I just couldn't contain it that much. I could a little, but I just waited it out and did more walking. Acceptance. And it's very important, like with the factors of enlightenment or for, with anything. It's like I've seen real extremes for people, or sometimes with myself like that. It's like often we're in some level of normality with this stuff, but sometimes we'll get something very extreme. So I had a student once at a three-month retreat. He had 3 months of restlessness. Just, it was awesome. Every interview, restlessness, you know, and it was really just like extraordinary, you know, that it can get like that, right? And then I had someone here 1 year that had just calm. Just every interview, calm. And then no matter what it is, people think it should be different, right? And I'm like, calm isn't so bad. It could be restlessness. And she's like, calm. And I'm like, calm. It's great, calm, calm. These things can take years to ripen or work themselves out. But I have to say, it's great to have, you know, have the experience to say, with this one guy with restlessness, he did some other long retreats and it didn't come up again. Like he came to another 3 months, gone. So, you know, it's very important to get that sense that we're each unique, and we will be, usually we're ripening one factor of enlightenment or several, and sometimes they all come into balance, or we're struggling with, we're usually not struggling with multiple hindrance attacks constantly. There's usually one or another that are more predominant. And this is how we grow and learn. So being able to, it's not like we disagree with the no, the resistance, as much as we say, okay, you know, it's okay. And then you open up around it and just investigate the physical, the corresponding physical sensations in your body. Particularly with resistance, it helps. Usually I say that the recognition, acceptance, interest, non-identification, it actually spells an acronym, RAIN. So we're at R-A and then I, interest. We've talked about it a bit, but you really can't force any of these. And interest and energy are very related. So that when we have enough energy, there's usually some interest in what's happening. And when we're tired, it's hard to muster up. You know, it's like that example of the young man with the frustration. It's like, you can see the way I was describing it. It was like, I'm a little frustrated, but I'm trying to be mindful. It's like he was accepting, he was trying to accept, but certainly there was no interest. And you'll see, I'm sure you've seen already, that when that, it's almost like it just comes, like this shift comes, and there'll be like this genuine interest in anything. And this is related to the fourth factor of enlightenment. It's called piti, or rapture. But I think of it as the deep delight in exploring the truth. It's like when there's enough energy, it's actually, we overcome the pain-pleasure syndrome. So we can become interested in pain as well as pleasure, as well as neutral. We're just interested in how life is, just as it is, the nature of how things are. And of course, then there's the opposite. You know, when it feels dull, when it feels boring, and of course, the shift to being able to accept that, that have the mindfulness of that and allow that is, the more you can allow the opposites, the more that you can actually, these will arise. The more you don't react to the being distracted, the more you don't react so much to the resistance or the dullness and boredom, the more you can be okay with it and explore it a bit or just let it be. The energy will come for the mindfulness. And then the N, non-identification, is actually the most difficult to describe. It's usually the most difficult to understand. But it means that we're not taking personally the experience that's happening, whatever it is. Again, so if it's boredom, my boredom is identification. Or if it's like knee pain, it's like my knee pain. Or if it's like a good sitting, it's my good sitting. Or if it's knowing, even if it's a subtle sense of being aware of awareness or knowing, it'll be my consciousness or my knowing. It's often, again, with all of these things, it'll just happen by itself. Something just opens up and you get a glimpse of like what the experience feels like when it's not a possessive, it's not possessive. It's not controlled. And how we get to know this so much is, you know, the opposite again. What does it feel like to be taking something personally? You know, so that it's meant to be something that you feel as a kind of suffering. And that's part of, again, on retreat, what can be hard is the suffering that is suffering, is having the time and space to actually feel the mind contract. It's here. The whole body can contract when we're triggered, but it's just that feeling of it's like so deeply painful for experience to be mine, because it isn't. It really is just like the weather passing through. And I really want to develop just a little bit more about the opposites, because we have to really explore what we do when these opposites are there. Like when resistance is there, check it out. It's where we tend to disconnect. And if the interest isn't there, we tend to disconnect. Or when the identification is there, we tend to disconnect. It's like we're not interested. And this is where we need to be really interested. When the practice is going great, you know, and think mindfulness, energy, concentration, equanimity, when things are more in balance, it's not that hard. I mean, it's hard enough because it takes, as you see, it takes so much protection to drop in like that. But it's when we're not dropped in, and when mindfulness is so elusive that it requires, you know, kind of really attempting. Sometimes I call it being okay with not being okay. It sounds paradoxical, but it is possible. And you've already done it. You've been here a week. I know you've been through low energy. I know you've been through boredom. There are so many times in my practice when I would like walk holding on to something, I'd be so tired. Just like, oh, better not fall over. If you look closely, again, that it's often when we feel the most off, or we're feeling the most suffering, when we're the most identified. And there's a phrase, karmic knot. There are certain experiences that we tend to want to hide, and that something will just get triggered, and sometimes it could be the fear of rejection or anger, or you know, fear of death or fear of getting sick. You know, we each have our own particular karmic knot, but it's like something we came in this lifetime with that is really something that we can't talk ourselves out of. You know, it's not rational. We can't just say, oh, get over it, or just try to be mindful of it. It's like it throws us off. And these require the most compassion, the most care. And I've learned probably the most about the seven factors of enlightenment from the karmic knots that I've had. So we tend to think of them as maybe the most difficult, but they're the most difficult. And I bring this back to like the beginning of the talk, where it was the normal to gifted range of kids that tended to be the most arrogant, meaning that they took a lot of their talent for granted. They took a lot of, like, their, you know, that it was easier for them to study than the kids that didn't have as much going for them. So in that way, it's harder. And so when we have a karmic knot appear, it's humbling. You know, and sometimes we just call it yogi mind. I don't know if you've heard that expression, yogi mind, but it's when we make a mountain out of a molehill and we just can't stop. It's just, we just go on and on and on. So in those cases, it's usually a hidden emotion. Again, it's like something that very young we slam the door on. We just like, that experience is really, it feels like you're going to die if you feel it or experience it, or it feels like you're going to lose some part of you if you experience it. And just take great care with those, because again, it'll distill down to aversion, attachment. It's still universal. And it's usually when we think that we can't take it anymore. So if you hit these places where it feels like you're really caught in something, and you know there's probably a hidden something underneath it, but it's like a knot, just cool out. You know, maybe just have something out of your thermos, some green tea, or just like look at something pretty for a while. Just take a little break, sit under, you know, just stop for a while and let it pass through. And it's a place that we often can't be very mindful, but we certainly can cultivate compassion. And you can cultivate just care, just keep caring for whatever's happening. Care is a very pleasant feeling. So something can be very painful in our body, physically, emotionally, or mentally, but the awareness that's caring about it, that's outside of it, that's caring from the outside in, feels good. And as I said, because we often learn to slam the door on certain experiences, it's like we're not getting skill with it. And that's the nature of a karmic knot, is just that we don't have the skill. And if we can even get a glimpse of working with it a little bit and then backing off, gentleness is the key. It's like you take a homeopathic dose of what's difficult, and then you feel like you accomplish something, rather than trying to get rid of it. Because that's what we tend to try to do with karmic knots. We think if we're just with it, we're going to get rid of this thing that has been bothering us our whole life. rather than seeing that it's not about getting rid of it, it's learning skill of how to be with it. So it doesn't have power over us. And this brings us to the other definition. Again, I've mentioned about mindfulness, but it's this, the soft readiness. Soft readiness really says it all. Readiness is that sense that mindfulness is having a strong mind that's ready for anything to happen. You know, and that the truth is that anything can happen. Unpleasant can happen at any time. So the protection isn't trying to seal ourselves off from anything unpleasant. It's really that you get this readiness of mindfulness to be with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. But if it gets so that it's impossible and it's too hard, you back off. You go to the anchor, which is meant to be neutral. Or sometimes if it's really bad, you seek out some pleasant so that you can balance yourself again. And soft is the soft side of this. The readiness is the kind of strong part, but the soft really is indicating that it's really that without the softness, there's no ability to receive experience. And honestly, I can say, you know, again and again, I see that for most of us, we want to let go of experience before we've actually experienced it. And just, it's just our human nature. We, you know, and that's why the phrase "let go, let go, let go." It's a beautiful phrase, and mindfulness has that quality of non-identification. But really, be careful of let go before you let be, let be, let be. That you're really interested and you can allow the experience and get skill, so that the next time fear comes along, you don't go, "I thought I got rid of that already." You know, it's like, that's what we do. It's not pure. We ask, what is pure motivation? It's just not about that. It's more like fear comes up and you go, "Wow, I really was able to be that with that a little bit last time. Maybe I can be with it a little bit more this time, but not expect it to go away. That maybe I'll get a little more skill." And then if I can't be with it, I move to the anchor. And don't worry, you don't have to worry about the fear never coming up again. You know, we don't have to worry that if we actually are gentle and decide, well, at this moment in time, I don't have the protection of compassion or mindfulness, that maybe I can move away skillfully. Because what we usually do is move away unskillfully. So here we have this chance of that balance again and again of learning how to move away skillfully or move into skillfully. Not to move into unskillfully and move away unskillfully. And I've really been bringing investigation in a bit, but investigation is said to be like when you go from a dark room and you're in the dark room and you turn on the light. So that it's that quality of, it's a kind of questioning that happens where the mindfulness is there, but it's like the awareness can start to get this bit of a little bit more. Can I get a little bit closer? Am I really just walking and it's just a leg, just my leg stepping on that earth over there? It's like the question would be, what is the experience right now, free from any past idea or past thought about it? So investigation requires the willingness not to know what something is. And it really cuts through arrogance. It's very humble. It's like being willing, even though you have already attempted to understand the breath, thousands of times, or being with the movement of the leg thousands of times, or boredom, or physical sensations, anything. But there's that willingness to check it out fresh. And the questions this morning to me were all about investigation and equanimity. It's like we tend to use our willpower to investigate. So for example, when I said with fear, if we're using our willpower with investigating fear, we're usually going to be investigating it to get rid of it. And if we're not using the willpower, but we're just using pure investigation, there wouldn't be any aversion or attachment coloring the investigation. Do you see the difference? One would be, I'm going to be with this to get rid of it or to get something. I want to get Nibbana out of being with this breath. That's not going to do it. I want to get rid of anger, so I'm going to be with anger. It's not it. It's not genuine. It's willpower. So investigation colored with aversion and attachment is just reinforcing aversion and attachment. It's not pure. So if you notice that that's what's happening, you don't go, stop it, that's bad. We're not saying these things are bad. We're just saying it isn't investigation. And to cool out, to build up the energy, which is the neck factor of enlightenment. Energy is called, virya is called courageous energy. It's courage. And all of these are interrelated. It takes courage to be genuinely interested. So if we don't have the courage, again, you rest skillfully with the anchor. And ultimately, that is the when you get that, the joy, like when Sayadaw talks about rejoicing, the rejoicing in the practice is when you start realizing the practice or life. Life keeps unfolding with courage and rest, courage and rest, courage and rest, skillfully. You get to know how to do that more and more skillfully. And of course, investigation is what lights up anicca, dukkha, anatta. That's for another talk. But that's the relationship with when investigation appears, not forced with willpower, but when it appears, one will understand not through the thought process more about anicca, dukkha, anatta. And this is done by not bearing down on what's happening, but by allowing what's happening to emerge by itself. It's said that the devas, the celestial beings, really like to hear about the seven factors of enlightenment, that they like to come around and hear it. So I hope the devas have enjoyed hearing about them. And I'd like to end with a quotation from Suzuki Roshi from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He said that when you realize that everything is just a flashing into this vast universe, you become very strong and your existence becomes very meaningful. So let's sit for a minute. So with each of us doing our best without forcing, but really doing our best, we all help each other in this liberation process. May we be happy and peaceful of heart.